advances the quest for social salvation. The first step in this epic inquiry is to take a closer look at our feelings, pain, pleasure, fear, anxiety, love, lust, and so on. Feelings play a very big role in shaping our perceptions and guiding us through life. Bigger than most people realize. Are they reliable guides? That's a question we'll start to examine in the next chapter. 3. When are feelings illusions? Hovering over the question posed by the title of this chapter is a larger question. What the hell are we talking about here? Illusions are things that seem to be true but aren't. And what would it even mean to say that feelings are true or false? Feelings just are. If we feel them, then they're feelings. Real feelings, not imagined feelings. End of story. There's something to be said for this point of view. In fact, one of the take-home lessons of Buddhist philosophy is that feelings just are. If we accepted their arising and subsiding as part of life, rather than reacting to them as if they were deeply meaningful, we'd often be better off. Learning to do that is a big part of what mindfulness meditation is about. And there are lots of satisfied customers who attest that it works. Still, saying that it works isn't the same as saying that it's intellectually valid. Just because being less reactive to some of your feelings makes you happier doesn't mean it brings a truer apprehension of the world. Maybe this less reactive stance is like a narcotic. It dulls the pain by insulating you from the real-world feedback that your feelings provide. Maybe it's meditation, not your ordinary consciousness, that puts you in a dream world. If we want to see whether meditation does, in fact, bring you closer to the truth, it helps to ask whether some of the feelings it can liberate you from would otherwise have carried you away from the truth. So we need to try to get a handle on this admittedly unwieldy question. Are our feelings in some sense false or true? Are some false and some true? And which are which? One way to approach these questions is to go back in evolutionary time. Way back. Back to when feelings first arose. Sadly, no one knows exactly when that was, or even approximately when that was. Was it back when mammals appeared? Reptiles? Squishy blobs floating in the sea? One-celled creatures such as bacteria? One reason it's hard to say is that feelings have an odd property. You can never be absolutely, positively sure that anyone or anything other than you has them. Part of the definition of a feeling is that it's private, not visible from the outside. So I don't know for sure that, say, my dog Frasier has feelings. Maybe that wagging tail is just a wagging tail. But just as I seriously doubt that I'm the only human with feelings, I seriously doubt that my species is the only species with feelings. I suspect that when my cousin the chimpanzee writhes in seeming pain, it is writhing in actual pain. And if, from chimpanzees, you go down the ladder of behavioral complexity, down to wolves, lizards, even jellyfish, and, what the hell, bacteria, I don't see an obvious place to stop assuming that there are feelings. Anyway, regardless of when feelings first arose, there is a rough consensus among behavioral scientists on what the original function of good feelings and bad feelings was, to get organisms to approach things or avoid things that are, respectively, good for them or bad for them. Nutrients, for example, keep organisms alive, so natural selection favored genes that gave organisms feelings that led them to approach things containing nutrients, that is, food. You may be familiar with such feelings. Things that harm or kill organisms, in contrast, are best avoided. So natural selection gave organisms feelings that inclined them to avoid such things, feelings of aversion. To approach or to avoid is the most elemental behavioral decision there is, and feelings seem to be the tool natural selection used to get organisms to make what, by natural selection's lights, was the right decision. After all, your average animal isn't smart enough to think, That substance is rich in carbohydrates, which give me energy, so I'll make a habit of approaching and ingesting it. In fact, your average animal isn't even smart enough to think, food good for me, so I approach. Feelings arose as proxies for this kind of thinking. The inviting warmth of a campfire on a freezing night means that staying warm is better for us than freezing. The pain caused by actual contact with the fire means that there's such a thing as too much warmth. The job of these and other feelings is to convey to the organism what's good for it and what's bad for it. As the biologist George Romanes put it in 1884, 25 years after Darwin's The Origin of Species appeared, pleasures and pains must have been evolved as the subjective accompaniment of processes which are respectively beneficial or injurious to the organism, and so evolved for the purpose, or to the end, that the organism should seek the one and shun the other. This suggests one way to think about whether feelings are true or false. Feelings are designed to encode judgments about things in our environment. Typically, these judgments are about whether these things are good or bad for the survival of the organism doing the feeling, though sometimes they're about whether these things are good or bad for close kin, notably offspring, since close kin share so many of our genes. So we could say that feelings are true if the judgments they encode are accurate, if, say, the things they attract the organism to are indeed good for it, or if the things they encourage the organism to avoid are indeed bad for it. We could say that feelings are false, or perhaps illusory, if they lead the organism astray, if following the feelings leads to things that are bad for the organism. This isn't the only way you could define true and false in a biological context, but it's one approach. So let's see how far we get with it. Obsolete urges. Take powdered sugar donuts. I personally have very warm feelings toward them, so warm that if I were guided only by my feelings, I would eat them for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and between-meal snacks. Yet I'm told that, actually, eating that many donuts each day would be bad for me. So I guess my feeling of attraction to powdered sugar donuts could be called false. These donuts feel good, but this is an illusion because they're not really good for me. This is, of course, hard news to take. It calls to mind the plaintive lyrics of that old Luther Ingram song, "If loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right." It also calls to mind a question. How could natural selection let something like this happen? Shouldn't our feelings direct us toward things that are good for the organism? They should, yes. But here's the thing. Natural selection designed our feelings in a particular environment, an environment with no junk food, an environment in which the sweetest thing available was fruit. So a sweet tooth served us well. It gave us feelings that, you might say, were true, in the sense that they steered us toward things that were good for us. But in a modern environment, which features the achievement of culinary science known as empty calories, these feelings become false, or at least not reliably true. They sometimes tell us something is good when it's not good for us. There are quite a few feelings like this, feelings that, back when they entered our lineage, served our ancestors' interests, but that don't always serve our interests now. Take road rage. The desire to punish people who treat you unfairly or show you disrespect is deeply human. And admit it, though there's something unpleasant about being made angry, there's something pleasing about the feeling of anger itself, the feeling that you're rightfully enraged. The Buddha said anger has a poisoned root and honeyed tip. And you can see why natural selection would have made righteous rage attractive. In a small hunter-gatherer village, if someone took advantage of you, stole your food, stole your mate, or just generally treated you like dirt, you needed to teach him a lesson. After all, if he learns he can get away with abusing you, he may do it again and again. Worse still, others in your social universe will see that you can be thus exploited, so they may start treating you badly. In such an intimate, unchanging social environment, it would be worth your while to get so angry over exploitation that you would confront your exploiter and be willing to come to blows. Even if you lost the fight, even if you got battered pretty badly, you'd have sent the message that there's a cost for disrespecting you, and this message would pay dividends over time. You may already be pondering the absurdity of the way this feeling can play out on a modern highway. The disrespectful driver you feel like punishing is someone you'll never see again, and so are all the drivers who might witness any revenge you wreak. So there's no benefit whatsoever that comes from indulging your rage. As for the cost, I'd guess that chasing somebody in a car at 80 miles per hour is more likely to get you killed than was starting a fistfight in a hunter-gatherer society. So you could call road rage false. It feels good, but the aura of goodness is illusory, because succumbing to its attraction leads to behavior that will not, on average, be good for the organism. There are lots of instances of off-road rage as well that are false. Bursts of anger that are at best unproductive and at worst counterproductive. So if meditation did liberate you from obedience to these feelings, it would be, in a certain sense, dispelling an illusion. The illusion you implicitly subscribe to when you follow the feeling. The illusion that the rage, and for that matter the revenge it inspires, is fundamentally good. It turns out the feeling isn't even good in the basic sense of self-interest. So that's one way to define true and false as they apply to feelings. If they feel good but lead us to do things that aren't really good for us, then they're false feelings. But there's another sense in which feelings can be true or false. Some feelings, after all, are more than feelings. They don't just imply judgments about whether doing certain things will be good for the organism. They come with actual, explicit beliefs about things in the environment and how they relate to the organism's welfare. Obviously, such beliefs can be true or false in a pretty straightforward sense. False positives. Suppose you're hiking through what you know to be rattlesnake terrain, and suppose you know that only a year ago, someone hiking alone in this vicinity was bitten by a rattlesnake and died. Now suppose there's a stirring in the brush next to your feet. This stirring doesn't just give you a surge of fear. You feel the fear that there is a rattlesnake near you. In fact, as you turn quickly toward the disturbance and your fear reaches its apex, you may be so clearly envisioning a rattlesnake that, if the culprit turns out to be a lizard, there will be a fraction of a second when the lizard looks like a snake. This is an illusion in a literal sense. You actually believe there is something there that isn't there. In fact, you actually see it. These kinds of misperceptions are known as false positives. From natural selection's point of view, they're a feature, not a bug. Though your brief conviction that you've seen a rattlesnake may be wrong 99 times out of 100, the conviction could be life-saving the other one time in 100. And in natural selection's calculus, being right 1% of the time in matters of life or death can be worth being wrong 99% of the time, even if in every one of those 99 instances, you're briefly terrified. So there are actually two differences between the snake illusion on the one hand and the donut and road rage illusions on the other. One, in the case of the snake, the illusion is explicit. It's an actual false perception about the physical world and, for a moment, a false belief. Two, in the case of the snake, your emotional machinery is working exactly as designed. In other words, the snake illusion isn't a result of environmental mismatch. It's not a case where a feeling designed by natural selection to be in some sense true in a hunter-gatherer environment was rendered false by circumstances of modern life. Rather, natural selection designed this feeling to be almost always illusory in a literal sense. The feeling fills you with a conviction, a judgment about what's in your immediate environment that is pretty reliably untrue. This is a reminder that natural selection didn't design your mind to see the world clearly. It designed your mind to have perceptions and beliefs that would help take care of your genes. Which brings us to a third difference between the donut and road rage illusions and the snake illusion. The snake illusion, in the long run, may well be good for you. It may keep you safe from harm that would otherwise befall you. The same goes for comparable illusions that, depending on where you live, might be more likely to visit you than a snake illusion. You might, while walking home at night, fear that the footsteps behind you belong to a mugger. And though you're probably wrong, crossing the street is a precaution that, over the course of your whole life, may prevent a crime that otherwise would have victimized you. I have a fear that all this may be sounding more clear-cut than it is. It may seem as if there are two kinds of false feelings, the unnatural, environmental mismatch kind, and the natural, false positive kind. And you should always ignore the former, whereas obeying the latter makes sense. In the real world, it turns out, these lines can get blurry. For example, have you ever been visited by the fear that something you said to someone had offended her? And has this person ever been someone you weren't going to see for a while? And has it been the case that, because you didn't know her very well, it would have been awkward to call her or send her an email to make sure you hadn't offended her, or to clarify that no offense was meant? The feeling itself, the concern that you've offended someone, is perfectly natural. Staying on good terms with people boosted our ancestors' chances of surviving and reproducing. Also natural, perhaps, is the fact that in some cases you're exaggerating the chances that you've offended the person, even feeling bursts of certainty that you've done so. This may be another one of nature's false positives. The sense that you've erred may be designed to be so powerful that you'll take remedial action more often than it's really called for. What's not natural is that remedial action is so hard to take. In a hunter-gatherer village, the person you feared you'd offended would live, 50 feet away from you, and you'd see her again in, 20 minutes or so. At that point, you could gauge her demeanor and perhaps be reassured that no offense was taken, or conclude that she was in fact miffed and try to rectify the situation. In other words, the initial feeling, even if illusory, is probably natural, designed to appear on occasions like this. What's not natural are features of the modern world that make it hard to find out whether the feeling was or wasn't an illusion. So the feeling lasts longer than is likely to be of any practical value, and unfortunately, the feeling is unpleasant. Another unpleasant product of environmental mismatch is painful self-consciousness. We're designed by natural selection to care, and care a lot, about what other people think of us. During evolution, people who were liked, admired, and respected would have been more effective gene propagators than people who were the opposite. But in a hunter-gatherer village, your neighbors would have had a vast database of your behavior, so you'd be unlikely, on any given day, to do anything that radically revised their opinion of you, for better or worse. Social encounters wouldn't typically have been high-pressure events. In the modern world, we often find ourselves in the unnatural position of meeting someone who knows little or nothing about us. That can add a little pressure to the occasion, and it may add more if your mother was prone to saying, "You get only one chance to make a good first impression." You may find yourself scanning the person for feedback so intensively that you start seeing things that aren't there. A social psychology experiment from the 1980s makes the point. A makeup artist put realistic-looking scars on the faces of the subjects who had been told that the purpose of the experiment was to see how a scar affected the way people reacted to them. The subjects were to have a conversation with someone, and the experimenters would observe the reaction. The subjects were shown their scars in a mirror, but then, right before their social encounter, they were told that the scar needed a bit of work. Moisturizer would be added to keep it from cracking. In fact, though, the scar was removed. Then the subjects headed out to their social encounters with a warped idea of what they looked like. After the encounters, they were debriefed. Had they noticed their conversation partner reacting to the scar? Oh yes, many of them said. In fact, when they were shown video of the conversation partner, they could point to those reactions. Sometimes, for example, the person would look away from them, obviously averting their eyes from the scar. So again, a feeling, an uncomfortable feeling of self-consciousness, sponsors a kind of perceptual illusion, a basic misreading of the behavior of others. Modern life is full of emotional reactions that make little sense except in light of the environment in which our species evolved. You may be haunted for hours by some embarrassing thing you did on a public bus or an airplane, even though you'll never again see the people who witnessed it, and their opinions of you therefore have no consequence. Why would natural selection design organisms to feel discomfort that seems so pointless? Maybe because in the environment of our ancestors, it wouldn't have been pointless. In a hunter-gatherer society, you're pretty much always performing in front of people you'll see again, and whose opinions therefore matter. My mother used to say, "We wouldn't spend so much time worrying about what other people think of us if we realized how seldom they do." She was right. Our assumption that people give much thought to us one way or the other is often an illusion, as is our unspoken sense that it matters what pretty much everyone we see thinks of us. But these intuitions were less often illusory in the environment of our evolution, and that's one reason they're so persistent today. Public speaking and other horrors. If there's anything more unnatural than being in the presence of a bunch of people you've never seen before, it's speaking to all of them at once. The mere thought of such an event can give us terrifying illusions about the future. Suppose you're giving some kind of presentation tomorrow. Maybe it's a PowerPoint talk. Maybe it's a presentation in some looser sense. Now suppose one further thing, that you're like me. If you're like me, as the time approaches, you may feel anxiety. What's more, this anxiety may feature bursts of conviction that things are going to go badly. You may even envision specific disaster scenarios. And, pretty reliably, these visions will turn out to be wrong. In retrospect, these anxiety-sponsored bursts of apocalyptic conviction were false positives. Of course, it's possible that the anxiety is the reason things wound up going well. Maybe it spurred you to prepare a great presentation. If so, those false PowerPoint apocalypse positives are different from false rattlesnake positives. After all, your momentary fear that a rattlesnake was afoot had no bearing on whether or not a rattlesnake would in fact turn out to be afoot. In contrast, your PowerPoint apocalypse anxiety may conceivably have headed off a PowerPoint apocalypse. Conceivably. But let's face it, though anxiety is sometimes productive in this sense, people do a lot of worrying that serves no good purpose. There are people who are beset by images of themselves projectile vomiting while talking to a crowd, even though, come to think of it, they've never projectile vomited while talking to a crowd. In a particularly perverse twist on PowerPoint apocalypse anxiety, I've been known to lie awake the night before a big presentation, worrying that if I don't get to sleep, I'll do a bad job the next day. Actually, that's an oversimplification. I don't just worry about not getting to sleep. For the sake of variety, I periodically interrupt that worry with bouts of self-loathing for being the kind of person who would worry so much about not getting to sleep that he'd be unable to get to sleep. Then, after my rage has subsided, I get back to the important business of worrying so much about not getting to sleep that I can't get to sleep. I'm proud to say that this doesn't happen before most of my public speaking events. But it's happened, and I defy anyone to argue that it is natural selection's way of increasing my chances of surviving and reproducing. So too with lots of other anxieties related to human social interaction. A sense of dread before going to a cocktail party that, in fact, is very unlikely to lead to anything that is worth dreading. Worrying about how your child is doing at her first slumber party, something you're powerless to influence. Or worrying about your PowerPoint presentation after you've given it, as if fretting over whether people liked it will change whether they did. I guess that all three of these examples have at least something to do with the way our environment has changed since the human species evolved. Our ancestral environment didn't feature cocktail parties, slumber parties, or PowerPoint. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors didn't have to navigate roomfuls of people they'd never met, or send their children off to sleep in homes they'd never seen, or give presentations to an audience consisting largely of people they didn't know very well, if at all. By the way, this mismatch between our evolved nature and the environment in which we find ourselves isn't just a modern phenomenon. For thousands of years, there have been human social environments that weren't the ones we were designed for. The Buddha was born to a royal family, which means he lived in a society with clusters of population much bigger than a hunter-gatherer village. And though PowerPoint hadn't been invented, there is evidence that people were being called on to speak before large audiences, and that something like PowerPoint apocalypse anxiety had taken shape. In one discourse, the Buddha listed as one of the five fears the fear of embarrassment in assemblies. This fear remains in the top five today. Some polls, in fact, show public speaking to be the most dreaded activity of all. Just to be clear, and at the risk of repeating myself, I'm not saying that social anxiety isn't in any sense a product of natural selection. The ancestral environment, the environment of our evolution, featured lots of social interaction, and this interaction had great consequence for our genes. If you had low social status and few friends, that cut your chances of spreading your genes, so impressing people mattered, even if PowerPoint wasn't the thing you impressed them with. Similarly, if your offspring didn't thrive socially, that boded ill for their reproductive prospects, and hence for your genes. So genes inclining us toward anxiety about our social prospects and our progeny's social prospects seem to have become part of the human gene pool. In this sense, our social anxieties can be considered natural, but they're operating in a very different environment from the environment they were designed for, and this fact may explain why they're often unproductive, sponsoring illusions that are of no value at all. Thus, can we have beliefs about, for example, the near certainty of impending disaster that are false both in the literal and the pragmatic sense? They aren't true, and they aren't good for us. If you accept the idea that many of our most troublesome feelings are in one sense or another illusions, then meditation can be seen as, among other things, a process of dispelling illusions. Here's an example. In 2003, a couple of months after my first meditation retreat, I traveled to Camden, Maine to give a talk in an annual conference called PopTech. The night before my talk, I woke up at 2 or 3 a.m. with one of my little bouts of anxiety. After a few minutes of staying awake, pondering the grave implications of staying awake, pondering grave implications, I decided to sit up in my bed and meditate. I focused on my breathing for a while, but I also focused on the anxiety itself, the tight feeling in my gut. I tried to look at it, as I'd been taught to do at my meditation retreat, non-judgmentally. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing, and there was no reason to run away from it. It was just a feeling. So I sat there feeling it and watching it. I can't say that the feeling felt great, but the more I accepted it, observing it non-judgmentally, the less unpleasant it got. And then something happened that was much like my big over-caffeination breakthrough at the meditation retreat. The anxiety now seemed like something removed from me, something I was just looking at in my mind's eye, the way I might look at an abstract sculpture in a museum. It looked like a kind of thick, knotted rope of tightness, occupying the part of my abdomen where anxiety is felt, but it didn't feel like tightness anymore. My anxiety, which had been painful only minutes earlier, now felt neither good nor bad. And not long after it attained this neutral status, it dissolved entirely. After a few minutes of this pleasant relief from suffering, I lay down and went to sleep. The next day, my talk went, I'll pause here to let the suspense build. Fine. It's possible, in principle, to attack anxiety from another angle. Rather than focus on the feeling itself, as I did that night, you investigate the thoughts associated with it. This is the way cognitive behavioral therapy works. Your therapist asks questions like, Is there much likelihood of screwing up that presentation, judging by your history of giving presentations? And if you did screw it up, would your career really vaporize on the spot? Then, if you see that the thoughts are lacking in logic, the attendant feelings may weaken. So cognitive behavioral therapy is very much in the spirit of mindfulness meditation. Both, in some sense, question the validity of feelings. It's just that with cognitive behavioral therapy, the questioning is more literal. By the way, if you're thinking about combining these two approaches and becoming famous as the founder of a whole new school of therapy, I have bad news. Mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy, MBCBT, already exists. Levels of delusion. A recap. If I've done my job, you should be feeling a bit deceived. Not by me, but by your feelings. And I haven't even gotten to the deepest, subtlest deceptions perpetrated by your feelings. I'll save those for later in the book. Meanwhile, let's review several senses in which feelings can be misleading. 1. Our feelings weren't designed to depict reality accurately, even in our natural environment. Feelings were designed to get the genes of our hunter-gatherer ancestors into the next generation. If that meant deluding our ancestors, making them so fearful that they see a snake that isn't actually there, say, so be it. This class of illusions, natural illusions, helps explain a lot of distortions in our apprehension of the world, especially the social world. Warped ideas about ourselves, about our friends, our kin, our enemies, our casual acquaintances, and even strangers. Which about covers it, right? 2. The fact that we're not living in a natural environment makes our feelings even less reliable guides to reality. Feelings that are designed to create illusions, such as seeing a snake that isn't there, may at least have the virtue of increasing the organism's prospects for surviving and reproducing. But the modern environment can take various kinds of feelings that served our ancestors in this Darwinian sense and render them counterproductive in the same sense. They may actually lower a person's life expectancy. Violent rage and the yearnings of a sweet tooth are good examples. These feelings were once true, at least in the pragmatic sense of guiding the organism toward behaviors that were in some sense good for it. But now they're likely to mislead. 3. Underlying it all is the happiness delusion. As the Buddha emphasized, our ongoing attempts to feel better tend to involve an overestimation of how long better is going to last. What's more, when better ends, it can be followed by worse, an unsettled feeling, a thirst for more. Long before psychologists were describing the hedonic treadmill, the Buddha saw it. What he couldn't have seen is its source. We were built by natural selection, and natural selection works to maximize genetic proliferation, period. In addition to not caring about the truth per se, it doesn't care about our long-term happiness. It will readily delude us about what does and doesn't bring lasting happiness if that delusion has propelled our ancestors' genes forward. In fact, natural selection doesn't even care about our short-term happiness. Just look at the price of all those false positives. Being terrified by a snake that isn't there 99 times in a row could take a toll on a person's psychological well-being. The good news, of course, is that on the 100th time, the fear may have helped keep our ancestors alive, and thus led ultimately to the creation of us. Still, we are the heirs of this tendency toward false positives, not just in the realm of snakes, but in the realm of other fears and everyday anxieties. As Aaron Beck, who is sometimes called the founder of cognitive behavioral therapy, has written, "The cost of survival of the lineage may be a lifetime of discomfort." Or, as the Buddha would have put it, a lifetime of dukkha. And the Buddha might have added, "But this cost is avoidable if you address the psychological causes of it head on." Obviously, this chapter hasn't been a blanket indictment of human feelings. Some, maybe most, of our feelings serve us reasonably well, They don't much distort our view of reality, and they help keep us alive and flourishing. My attraction to apples, my aversion to grasping knife blades and scaling skyscrapers, all to the good. Still, I hope you can see the virtue of subjecting your feelings to investigation, inspecting them to see which ones deserve obedience and which ones don't, and trying to free yourself from the grip of the ones that don't. And I hope you can see why this is difficult. It's in the nature of feelings to make it hard to tell the valuable ones from the harmful ones, the reliable from the misleading. One thing all feelings have in common is that they were originally designed to convince you to follow them. They feel right and true almost by definition. They actively discourage you from viewing them objectively. Maybe this helps explain why it took me so long to get the hang of mindfulness meditation, why it never worked for me until I took the full immersion approach and went on a one-week silent meditation retreat. But it's not the only reason. There are other things about the way feelings influence us that make it hard to turn the tables on them and reverse the servant-master relationship. And there are other things about the way the mind works that make it hard to sink into a meditative state in the first place. Indeed, it was only after I went on that first retreat that I started to realize how challenging it can be, and why it can be so challenging, to get to the point where mindfulness meditation is really working. Then again, rewarding things often require work. And another thing I started to realize on that retreat is how great the rewards of mindfulness meditation can be. Indeed, those rewards go so far beyond the ones hinted at in this chapter that I fear I may have trivialized the meditative experience. Sure, starting to get a grip on a few of your more troublesome feelings is great, and if knowing that these feelings are in one sense or another false helps you do that, so much the better. But the taming of troublesome feelings can be just the beginning. There are other dimensions of mindfulness, and there are insights much deeper and subtler than the realization that maybe surrendering to road rage isn't such a great idea. 4. Bliss, ecstasy, and more important reasons to meditate. Strictly speaking, silent meditation retreat is a misnomer. On my first week-long retreat, back in the summer of 2003, there were two times when students spoke with a meditation teacher. On one of those occasions, a group of 8 or 9 of us yogis assembled in a room near the meditation hall. There, for 45 minutes, we could air any problems we were having. Which was good, because I was having a problem. I couldn't meditate. I hadn't yet had my big meditation breakthrough, that moment when I viewed my overcaffeination mindfully and transcended it. All I had done was spend a day and a half failing to concentrate on my breath. I tried and tried, but I just couldn't stop thinking about stuff. So when my turn came to speak, I gave voice to this frustration. The ensuing dialogue with my teacher went something like this. "So you notice that your mind keeps wandering?" "Yes." "That's good." "It's good that my mind keeps wandering?" "No, it's good that you notice that your mind keeps wandering." "But it happens, like, all the time." "That's even better. It means you're noticing a lot." This didn't have the uplifting effect that my teacher had perhaps intended. I felt a bit patronized. It was kind of like those times when one of my daughters, back in the toddler stage, would fail abjectly at something, and I'd strain to find an encouraging word. Maybe she would fall down while trying to get on a tricycle, and I'd say, "You got back up! What a big girl!" Neglecting to note that, actually, big girls don't fall down while trying to get on tricycles in the first place. But I've since come to realize that this first bit of feedback I ever got from a meditation teacher wasn't just strained encouragement. My teacher was right. By frequently noticing that my mind was wandering, I was breaking new ground. In my ordinary workaday life, when my mind wandered, I would follow it over hill and dale, not even aware that I was being led. Now I was following it for only short stretches before breaking free, at least briefly free. Free for long enough to realize it had been leading me. a realization that would then give way to its leading me some more. To put this in more scientific-sounding terminology, I was beginning to observe the workings of what psychologists call the default mode network. This is a network in the brain that, according to brain scan studies, is active when we're doing nothing in particular, not talking to people, not focusing on our work or any other task, not playing a sport or reading a book or watching a movie. It is the network along which our mind wanders when it's wandering. As for where the mind wanders to, well, lots of places, obviously, but studies have shown that these places are usually in the past or the future. You may ponder recent events or distant, strong memories. You may dread upcoming events or eagerly anticipate them. You may strategize about how to head off some looming crisis, or fantasize about romancing the attractive person in the cubicle next to yours. What you're generally not doing when your mind is wandering is directly experiencing the present moment. In one sense, it's not hard to quiet your default mode network. Just do something that requires concentration. Do a crossword puzzle or try to juggle 3 tennis balls. Until you get to a point where juggling is second nature, you probably won't be fantasizing about the attractive person in the cubicle next to yours. What's hard is to abandon the default mode network when you're not doing much of anything, like, say, when you're sitting in a meditation hall with your eyes closed. That's why you try to focus on the breath. The mind needs some object of focus to wean it from its habitual meandering. But even with this crutch available, you may find yourself in the position I was in during the early part of that retreat, being repeatedly, frequently, helplessly carried away from experiential mode into default mode. Every time you realize you've been carried away, it's tempting to feel frustration or anger or, my personal favorite, self-loathing. But the standard instruction is to not waste time on that. Instead, just note the fact that your mind was wandering, and perhaps even note what kind of wandering it was doing. Dreading work, looking forward to lunch, lamenting a bad golf shot. And then return your focus to the breath. My teacher, in highlighting the silver lining surrounding my cloud of diffuse attention, was no doubt trying to encourage me to do just that. This turned out to be good guidance. By interrupting the workings of my default mode network, by snapping out of it and realizing that my mind was wandering, and then returning to my breath, I was diluting the network's dominance. As I got better at focusing on my breath for longer periods, this network would become less and less active. At least, that's a pretty fair guess. Brain scan studies have shown this happening in novice meditators. Such studies have also shown that highly adept meditators, people who have meditated for tens of thousands of hours and are in a whole nother league from me, exhibit dramatically subdued default mode networks while meditating. When the default mode network subsides, when the mind stops wandering, it can be a good feeling. There can be a sense of liberation from your chattering mind, a sense of peace, even deep peace. You may not get this feeling every time you meditate, but for some people, it happens often enough that it's one of the main inducements to get back on the cushion the next day, part of the positive reinforcement that sustains the practice. But once you get to this point, once you've used your breath to gain some measure of escape from your wandering mind, you're at a crossroads. There are 2 different paths you can follow, corresponding to 2 different types of meditation. Concentration and mindfulness. One path is to sustain the focus on your breath, the focus it felt good to establish in the first place, for a long, long time, and try to tighten and deepen the focus, becoming more immersed in the breath. Then just keep going. You may find yourself feeling better and better and better. This is called concentration meditation, and the object of concentration doesn't have to be breath. Depending on the meditation tradition, the object can be a mantra, an imagined visual image, a recurring sound, whatever. Concentration meditation is sometimes referred to as serenity meditation, which makes sense, because the concentration can bring serenity. Indeed, the concentration can bring more than serenity. Sometimes, if sustained for long enough, it can bring powerful feelings of bliss or ecstasy. And I mean powerful feelings of bliss or ecstasy. On the fifth night of my first retreat, I had been experimenting with a modified version of the standard focus on your breath technique. I was focusing on my breath during the inhale, but on sounds during the exhale. Focusing on sounds was easy because it was a hot summer night in rural Massachusetts, and the windows of the meditation hall were open, and a chorus of insects, cicadas, I assume, was chanting loudly. As I meditated, I got more tightly focused on my breath and the chanting, both of which seemed to grow in intensity as they absorbed my attention more and more fully. At some point, after 25 or 30 minutes of meditation, I had a dramatic and powerful experience that's hard to describe. Later in this book, I'll do my best to describe it, but for now I'll just say that it was very, very vivid. In fact, I'd like to add another very to that last sentence. I don't know from first-hand experience what it would be like to take LSD and follow it with a heroin chaser, but I guess it's something like the experience I had that night. Intensely visual, bordering on hallucinatory, and intensely blissful. I remember feeling as if my jaw, in particular, had been injected with some powerful narcotic. My whole being buzzed with joy and vision, and I felt as if I had crossed some threshold and entered another realm. If the experience I had that night sounds appealing, I have some bad news. The kind of meditation that gave me this peak experience, concentration meditation, isn't the kind of meditation this book is about. And it's not the kind of meditation that the retreat I was on was supposed to be about. When, at the end of the retreat, I proudly told Michael Grady, one of the retreat's two teachers, about my peak experience, he said with a nonchalance that I found a bit dispiriting, "Sounds nice, but don't get attached to it." This retreat was supposed to be about mindfulness meditation, the second of the two basic meditative paths you can take. Mindfulness and concentration are such important Buddhist aspirations that each constitutes one of the eight parts of the Eightfold Path that a deeply committed Buddhist is supposed to tread. In fact, they are the seventh and eighth parts, respectively. But that doesn't mean they are the culminating parts, because the term Eightfold Path is misleading in its suggestion of sequence. The idea isn't that you completely master the first of these eight factors, right view, and then move on to the second and third, right intention and right speech, and so on. There is too much interdependence among the eight factors for such linear progress. So, for example, progress in the seventh and eighth factors, right mindfulness and right concentration, will help foster a deeply experiential understanding of core Buddhist principles and hence strengthen right view. What's more, and what's more relevant to this chapter, although right mindfulness comes before right concentration on the Eightfold Path, cultivating mindfulness may require first cultivating concentration. That's why the early part of a mindfulness meditation session typically involves focusing on your breath or on something else. Mustering some concentration is what liberates you from the default mode network and stops the mental chatter that normally preoccupies you. Then, having used concentration meditation to stabilize your attention, you can shift your attention to whatever it is you're now going to be mindful of, usually things that are happening inside you, such as emotions or bodily sensations, though you can also focus on things in the outside world, such as sounds. Meanwhile, the breath recedes to the background, though it may remain your anchor, something you're fuzzily aware of even as you examine other things, and something you may return your attention to from time to time. The key thing is that whatever you're experiencing, you experience it mindfully, with that ironic combination of closeness and critical distance that I mentioned in describing how I had viewed the feeling of overcaffeination. I realize that mindfully viewing some feeling you're having, anxiety or restlessness, for example, may not sound as exotically appealing as the psychedelic ecstasy that concentration meditation brought me on that summer night in Massachusetts. But there are several consolations of pursuing mindfulness meditation, and some of them have their exotic aspects. Mindfulness in real life. First, mindfulness meditation is good training. Viewing your feelings mindfully while on a meditation cushion can make you better at viewing them mindfully in everyday life, which means your life will be less governed by misleading or unproductive feelings. You spend less time fuming at drivers who, inexcusably oblivious to the important appointment you're late for, take a couple of seconds to hit the accelerator after the light turns green. Less time yelling at your kids or your spouse or yourself or whoever you're inclined to yell at. Less time pointlessly resenting indignities inflicted on you. Less time having revenge fantasies about the inflictors, not that such fantasies are without their pleasures, and so on. Another virtue of mindfulness meditation is that it can make you more attuned to beauty. This effect is especially dramatic on a retreat, when you're doing so much meditating and when your isolation from the real world is limiting the number of things for you to worry about, eagerly anticipate, or bitterly regret. With your default mode network deprived of fresh fuel, it's easier to stay in experiential mode. This deepened absorption in everyday sensations can change your consciousness dramatically. Birdsong can sound surreally pretty. Textures of all kinds, the surface of bricks, of asphalt, of wood, can be enthralling. During a mid-retreat walk in the forest, I once found myself caressing, yes, pretty literally caressing, the intricately sculpted trunk of a tree. And believe me when I tell you, I am not the tree-hugging type. More generally, I'm not the stop-and-smell-the-roses type. On a typical workday, here is the way I eat lunch. Open a can of sardines, get a fork, eat the sardines directly out of the can while standing in front of the kitchen sink, throw the can away. There, done with lunch. But after a few days on my first retreat, I found myself taking the opposite approach to eating, which is all the more surprising given how Spartan the food was by conventional standards. Strictly vegetarian, no store-bought snacks, and, most disturbing of all, chocolate on a less-than-daily basis. The first time I entered the dining hall at mealtime, I was puzzled as to why so many people were eating with their eyes closed. Before long, I got the picture. Shuttering the visual field brought absorption and taste closer to 100%. The result was sublime. A single bite of salad, chewed slowly, savored not just for flavor but for texture, could bring 15 seconds of near bliss. So imagine the buttered cornbread. On retreat, common visual experiences can assume a kind of drama. I remember reaching to open an aged screen door and suddenly feeling as if I were watching a movie, one of those scenes where an ultra-close-up shot of something ordinary signals something momentous to come. Of course, nothing momentous came, unless you count the next dramatic visual experience, which tended to come soon. Once, on that first retreat, I was in my dorm room, jotting observations on index cards, when I looked up at the drawn window shade and recorded this. While writing this card, get dazed by beauty of mottled pattern. Sun hitting it through trees and screen. Feels like a narcotic. Speaking of pharmaceuticals, if I'm going to sing the praises of meditation retreats, I'm obliged to mention possible side effects. The very silence and seclusion that frees you from workaday concerns also give you time to get immersed in other concerns, notably personal or family issues that in everyday life might visit you and even revisit you, but not settle in for a long stay. What's more, being in closer-than-usual contact with the actual workings of your mind can lead you to confront issues with a new and perhaps unsettling honesty, which is just as well when you think about it. Isn't much of the point of Buddhism to confront suffering rather than evade it, and by confronting it, by looking at it unflinchingly, undermine it? In my experience, this usually works. I tend to work through issues that haunt me on a retreat, gaining a new and healthy perspective on them. Still, the working through part can take a while and can get intense. I sometimes tell people that going on a long meditation retreat is like doing extreme sports for the mind. It features both the sublime and the harrowing. I'm happy to say that in my experience, the ratio is about 4-1. When I'm not on retreat and my morning meditation is confined to 30 minutes, perhaps followed by a shorter sitting later in the day, the rewards are less dramatic. None of my neighbors has ever dialed 911 to report that I was caressing their trees. Still, so long as I keep up my daily meditation, I am more likely to stop while walking my dogs and look at the bark of a tree. And I'm more inclined to savor my sardines or, while eating them, actually see the trees through the kitchen window. At this point, I will refrain from delivering an extended sermon on living in the moment or being in the present or staying in the now or any other combination of those three verbs and those three nouns. With everyone from evangelical ministers to professional golfers singing the praises of present-mindedness, this theme needs no assistance from me. Besides, to put too much emphasis on living in the now would be to give short shrift to the potential of mindfulness meditation and, in a sense, to mislead you about the heart of Buddhist teaching. As I suggested in the first chapter, the Satipatthana Sutta, the ancient text known as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, contains no injunction to live in the now. In fact, there is no term in the entire text that is translated as now or the present. This doesn't mean that staying in the present wasn't part of the experience of Buddhist meditators 2 millennia ago. If you focus on your breathing or on bodily sensations, as prescribed in ancient mindfulness texts, the present is where you will be. Still, if you want to go full-on Buddhist, if you want to take the red pill, you need to understand that staying in the present, though an inherent part of mindfulness meditation, isn't the point of the exercise. It is the means to an end, not the end itself. Approaches to Enlightenment. Which brings us to the subject of enlightenment. Becoming enlightened, in the Buddhist sense of the term, would entail wholly ridding yourself of the twin illusions from which people tend to suffer, the illusion about what's in here, inside your mind, and about what's out there, in the rest of the world. Just in case this state of perfect understanding doesn't sound appealing, I should add that another term used to describe it is liberation, as in liberation from suffering, or at least from dukkha, however you choose to translate that multifaceted word. And yet another term for this state is nirvana. Surely you've heard of nirvana. There is some controversy over how accessible enlightenment is. Some people think it's a realistic goal for all of us. Some people think it's so elusive that to find it you'll have to head off to a forest in Asia and work on the project 24/7 for months, if not years. And some people say it's not really attainable at all. True, pure enlightenment, in this view, is like what mathematicians call an asymptote, something you can get closer and closer to, but never quite reach. How many people there are who have attained enlightenment, and for that matter, whether there are any, are questions I'm not qualified to answer. But there do seem to be people who so thoroughly dispel illusions about what's in here and what's out there that they cross some sort of threshold. They attain and then more or less sustain a state of consciousness that is radically different from ordinary consciousness, and that, by their account, is exceedingly pleasant. Which leads to the obvious question. How did they do it? How exactly would you go about getting enlightened, or at least getting close enough to enlightenment to feel genuinely transformed, to feel that you've entered a whole new world? There's a natural tendency to think of these transformations as sudden and powerful. After all, isn't that the way the great spiritual apprehensions happen? Moses in the burning bush, Muhammad in the cave, Paul on the road to Damascus. Even the Buddha is said to have seen the light in a single epic episode of meditation. And if you doubt how vividly dramatic this moment was, just check out the enlightenment scene in the movie Little Buddha, which, like The Matrix, features Keanu Reeves in the lead role. Talk about great visuals. If you think of meditation this way, think of its aim as being a dramatic and overwhelming experience of revelation, of enlightenment, you might conclude that